We're here for our third oral argument on our calendar. Marshall, can you call the case?
Calling case 821-1304, Christine Stelvin Connolly, petitioner respondent, versus Sean Timothy Connolly, appellant.
All right. Let's proceed. As you know, appellant has 15 minutes. Respondent has 15 minutes and appellant has 5 minutes for rebuttal. You know, wave flag if there, if you find that there's any technical issues with our technology or your technology, and we'll fix everything as quickly as we can and get it rolling. With that, counsel for appellant, Mr. Gainsley, why don't you proceed when you're ready and first identify yourself for the record, because an audio recording of this argument will be posted online after the close of our calendar today. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Philip Gainsley for the appellant, Sean Connolly, who's also present with us. May it please the court, at the hearing on April 7, referee Fernstall found Mr. Connolly to be in default for failure to file a written response, granted Ms. Connolly's motions, and instructed her attorney to prepare an order. And then 2 weeks later, the court adopted counsel's proposed order in its entirety with no alterations. And among the provisions in the proposed order was the appointment of Carol Devitt, who had been involved in this matter almost from the beginning. And it directed her, quote, to determine the amounts of spousal maintenance and child support husband must pay to effectuate an equalization of the party's incomes. Notwithstanding Ms. Connolly's assertions in her brief to the contrary, Your Honor, Your Honors, Mr. Connolly did not and does not object to the appointment of Ms. Devitt as a neutral under the rules of evidence, never did. But of all the findings of fact proposed, none of them, not a single one, supported an equalization of income. There's a finding that Ms. Connolly requested an equalization, but there's no finding that purports to support an equalization. Yet the court, in adoption of the of counsel's proposed findings, ordered the equalization of the party's incomes without finding any reason therefore. And this court almost weekly, almost monthly certainly, says that conclusions of law must have findings sufficient to support them. On May 3, 2 days before the court's scheduled review hearing, I wrote the court, that's document number 134, advising that I had been retained, questioning the application of the equalization of the party's income, requesting a Rule 76 hearing to review Ms. Devitt's conclusions, and asking leave to respond to Ms. Connolly's motion. The court didn't deny any of the requested relief. It simply ignored my requests, and a week later, on May 11, it filed an order already signed on April 30. Document number 135. The April 30 order filed.
Can I interrupt just for 1 minute?
Please.
So if you could clarify, and I apologize for I should know this, I guess, but I will make sure I do. Was the initial, the dissolution, did that call for an equalization?
I don't believe so. I think equalization, I wasn't the attorney involved, but equalization came when there was a time when the Mr. Connolly's income took a substantial reduction, and the court found at that time that both parties, the expression goes, must share the pain. And I believe that's when it started. I don't know that it, I can't tell you for certainty, but I know that when the income of Mr. Connolly was substantially reduced, the court did find an equalization of income and ruled that that would be prevalent. The April 30 order that was filed on May 11 directed Ms. Devitt, quote, to make recommendations with respect to her duties and to so advise the parties and this court of written recommendations.
Mr. Gainsley, can I go back to your earlier arguments? You're not contesting the appointment of the neutral financial expert. Am I correct?
Correct.
All right. So the only issue, you want to basically argue the loans from the family. Am I correct about that?
Well,
I mean, you want a chance to say those loans are really income and therefore she doesn't need an increase in spouse maintenance. Isn't that what you're
arguing? I think that overly simplifies it. Certainly, I think Ms. Devitt should have been aware of all this money that Ms. Connolly has had at the resources, especially in the most recent cases decided by this court. But that's not all. If you really want to simplify it, Judge Hooten, Mr. Connolly was shut out of court, rendered a mere observer, simply because he failed to file something in response to the motion. He appeared. He did not object to Ms. Devitt being appointed. But everything was to be, quote, consistent with the Minnesota Rule of Evidence 706.
And Mr. Gainsley, I understand that he appeared, but he hadn't provided discovery. And he also... He really didn't raise a lot of the arguments that you, as his new attorney, are raising now at that hearing. And the judge, taking in the evidence that was presented, ruled in favor of all the wife's motions, right?
Only because...
From the bench.
Really because he didn't file. And Your Honor, if I may correct you, he was not deficient on discovery. There was no discovery motion made. He was not deficient. And this goes, Your Honor, to, and I really wanted to get to it later, but it goes to a footnote I made in my principal brief. When a judge says to a party, prepare an order, a judge really has the responsibility to read that order and not to sign it in blank. And counsel, being an advocate, wrote an order, prepared an order that was unduly harsh and that contained things that were not really found. He was not in default of discovery. He was not in default of maintenance. He was not in default of child support. Yes, he made a mistake. He should have appeared. But to use the most harsh remedy available to the court, frankly, simply because he was leaving
Hold on a minute, though. So couldn't the court decide? I mean, where is it? Does it say that there was an entitlement to an evidentiary hearing in response to this motion? There's this neutral appointed. Couldn't the court determine that there really aren't enough facts in issue here and that I can just decide this on the submission?
No.
Just how much is he making?
No.
Oh, he's making more.
No.
I mean, what's wrong with that? What is it the former wife's family's responsibility to support her? Or is it, you know, I don't see that any place. So what makes it a right to be able to put in evidence? I mean, the May 14th order said in the event of a hearing or a trial.
Yeah, let's go into that. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Yes. Where did that May 14th order come from? It came from the blue. It came 3 days after the May 11th order. And suddenly we get, the counsel submits a new order. I have no time to respond to it because the court signed it immediately. And now we have a May 11th order under which we were presumably to operate. And then suddenly out of the blue, no request, no letter, nothing in support of it, on May 14th issues an order adding this language in the event of trial or evidentiary hearing, twice adding it. And I need to call the court's attention to the appositive in that rule, in that order, which says consistent with the Minnesota Rule of Evidence 706. In other words, that controls. But where did this language come from? That's not in the rule. Who asked?
May I ask you? Because there's a lot of focus on the procedure, but I want to get to substantively what is your problem with the order and what happened. You referenced at the start of it that there was not an adequate factual finding to order equalization to be the result. I'm not really sure I see that in your briefing as like the basis for the direction that the income or the cash flow would be equalized is lacking a factual finding. But I understand you had to have raised that here today, that should not have been, even though the pain was equalized, the benefit apparently should not have been equalized when the salary went up. But then also you're arguing now that, oh, I didn't have a chance to cross-examine the expert. What did you not get to find out about the expert in cross-examination? What's your challenge to the expert's report here?
The expert's report made certain assumptions. The expert's report did not make the assumption of what the true income was of Ms. Connolly.
And that has to do with the loans again, the family or the family support. Right. Is that what you're talking about?
You know, Your Honor, you're referring to them as loans. I have no evidence that they're loans and not gifts.
Okay, the family support.
I would like the family revenue, okay. But I don't want to characterize it as loans because they weren't loans. There weren't loans. No evidence of loans. She says she borrowed. I'd like to see the promissory note. I'd like to see the amortization schedule. I'd like to see the history of repayment. There were no loans here, Your Honor. And we just have to call it for what it is. In any event, that's why I wanted to do discovery. That's exactly.
Can I ask you this question, though? Because sure. She made a statement as part of her hearing or submitted an affidavit that these were loans. That's the evidence the judge had at the time that the judge decided this matter. And it appears that the judge basically said, I'm granting all your motions, and all I need is this neutral financial expert to implement this order. Why isn't that the case? And why shouldn't the judge be able to make that ruling based on the evidence that was produced at that hearing?
Because Ms. Devitt, the neutral, did not have before her the true income of Ms. Connolly, and that would have changed her result. I mean, she made certain assumptions, and she didn't make the assumption because it wasn't placed before her. I'm not faulting her at all. She didn't make the assumption of the money, the revenue, however you characterize it, from the family to Ms. Connolly.
Otherwise, wouldn't, if we did what you want us to do, wouldn't your client be getting another bite at the apple, even though he already had the hearing and the judge made a determination?
You know, Your Honor, the answer is yes. Yes, he should have another. Yes, he made a mistake. He should have filed something in response. I understand that. But we don't punish a guy for the rest of his life because of the failure that he made initially. He did appear. I must say, Your Honor, and I don't mean this in disrespect to Referee Fernstahl, whom I knew well and appeared successfully in that there was no issue. He was in a hurry to get rid of this case because he was leaving the bench. He said that on the record. I want to get this done before I leave the bench. And I'm afraid haste made waste here. And I'm afraid that Mr. Connolly is paying for that. That's the practical answer as to what happened here. Yes, he should have. He should have. But we don't take the most strenuous. We don't take the most punitive result as of steps as a result of his failure to appear.
Mr. Gainsley, I'm also looking at the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order that was issued on April 7, 2021. And in the findings of fact, the judge listed all of the various items that were being requested as part of that motion. And I'm looking at B, ordering that Carol DeVitt of Baker Tilly be appointed as a neutral to run cash flow as directed by the court to determine spousal maintenance and child support obligations necessary to equalize income between the parties, and that her fees be shared equally. In light of that was the item, and the judge said, I grant all of the motions brought by the wife. Isn't that sufficient direction? Sufficient basis for Ms. DeWitt to act as the neutral in this matter?
No. He signed an order that was proposed, prepared by Ms. Connolly's attorney, and that overreached. There was no evidence. He can't simply make that order without a factual finding. You need the finding as to why there's equalization, not simply because she requested it.
What's the factual finding that you would imagine would support equalization that's missing?
that would support equalization?
Yeah, I don't know. Yes. What factual findings are necessary to support an equalization approach to determining spousal maintenance on this motion?
Well, there should not have been an equalization. I mean, Mr. Connolly was making more money now. He could afford to pay maintenance as the statute requires, not necessarily equalization. And why there was equalization under the new income the subsequent income that Mr. Connolly was earning is different from when the parties had to, quote, share the pain, not my expression, their expression. But simply because a party requests it does not result in the court ordering it. You have to have a finding that what the party requested is supporting that conclusion. And there was no finding that equalization was the proper standard in this instance. If I can have... Judge Yellowhammer said, I've heard enough. I don't need to know anymore. And I suggest and I urge that that's begging the question. She doesn't know that there's nothing more to consider until she hears everything before her. That's what Rule 706 says. She's begging the question. I don't need to have an evidentiary hearing because I don't need an evidentiary hearing. That simply doesn't make sense. And that's what she said. There's nothing more for me to consider. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent. Identify yourself. Is it Ms. Newman who's here? Or?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Kathleen Newman on behalf of respondent, who is also appearing remotely.
Great. All right. Oh, we'll give you an extra 50 seconds. Go ahead. I mean, 10 seconds. Go ahead.
What we have here is a clear case of a scofflaw attempting to avoid his legal responsibilities by making unfounded arguments in an attempt to obtain another bite of the apple. I think a bit of the history of this case might be helpful, and it does go to Judge Siegel's question. It is uncontested that as a result of the trial in this matter in 2016, referee Fernstahl, who had been the judicial officer throughout this case until his retirement, awarded the wife permanent spousal maintenance. The award was based on the court's finding that husband's annual gross income was $216,500 and that wife's imputed gross income was $35,000. As noted in the findings, both parties submitted budgets at trial. Wife's had a $13,000 budget a month if she wasn't working, and I think $15,000 if she was to get a job. Husband presented a budget of over $9,000. And these were both standard of living budgets. And if you look at the judgment decree, referee Fernstahl, who tried the case, stated specifically that these budgets were unrealistic in view of the parties' then income, the $216,000 and the $35,000. He also noted that standard of living budgets had been maintained by use of the party's retirement assets and the very substantial debt that they incurred and the failure of husband to pay his taxes. And so what he did in the judgment decree with specific findings was said this was an equalization of income case. And he did that based on the husband's request at trial to utilize income equalization. Now, that's not an uncommon thing to do in these cases where, upon divorce, the combined income is not sufficient for each party to have a standard of living budget. And so it's not uncommon for the court, in the case like the facts here, year where wife had been out of the job market for many years to equalize income. Now, we knew at trial, right as the trial started, that husband had lost his job on which the $216,500 income was based. He had a severance package. Shortly after, I think it was in May, when the court issued its amended judgment decree, which awarded wife $3,930 in spousal maintenance and $1,879 in child support. Shortly after that order was entered, husband brought a motion to modify spousal maintenance and child support. And he did that based on the fact that he had gone to work for a company that his family had an ownership interest in. And he claimed that instead of the $216,000 income annually, he was now going to earn $135,000 in annual income. And referee Fernstall did the same thing at husband's request, the same thing he did during the divorce trial, and equalized income so that both parties would bear the pain. So that was the second time that income equalization was used. Now, from 2017 until she learned in 2020 that husband had a promotion, and she learned this by a LinkedIn notification, wife was trying to subsist to exist on the $507 a month spousal maintenance and her earnings in a retail sales job and some child support. Just as had happened during the divorce, when husband had engaged in a lot of unsavory behavior, she didn't have enough money to support herself and the children. And just like at the time of the divorce, she borrowed funds from her family to pay her legal fees, her expert fees, and to meet expenses for herself and the children. That was contested by husband at trial because the claim at trial was that that debt should be considered marital debt. And referee Fernstall took, I think it was $20,000 of that debt and said it was marital and included it as part of the property division. Fast forward now to 2017 until 2020, again, on $504 a month of spousal maintenance and some child support, and her earnings as a retail salesperson, she couldn't support the family. They're living in Connecticut. The standard of living expenses were very high there. And she again borrowed money from her family to meet her expenses. Now, counsel claimed there was no evidence to support that. But that goes to Judge Hooten's question. The evidence was in the sworn affidavit of my client in her initial filing in February of 2001. Now, in his brief, counsel argues that his client only had 21 days before the March hearing or April hearing to do discovery and prepare in response to the motion that wife had supplemented. So, as is common in family law cases, she brought a motion to preserve the retroactivity of the maintenance award, and that was in February. And then she proceeded to do discovery. Now, counsel argues with absolutely no basis that his client wasn't deficient in discovery. Well, the court found he was deficient in his discovery. And when they went to the April hearing, he hadn't filed any motion papers. He hadn't done any discovery of his own in this two-month period. He did absolutely nothing at all. He did not ask after the March supplemental pleadings were filed for continuance to do discovery. He did nothing but show up. And even though he didn't have to do that, referee Fernstall allowed him to make both testimony, because he put him under oath, and argument about his position. And he didn't raise the issue, again, as Judge Hooten tried to clarify in the beginning, this whole issue is about the debt, the $87,000 that Mr. Gainsley and his client would like the court to spread out over some period of time and use it to increase my client's earned income. And that's the crux of the issue here. They don't have any disagreement with what Carol Devitt did, and I want to point out she has been the neutral expert from trial to his motion, to husband's motion to modify and reduce his spousal maintenance obligation to the current hearing. This is or the hearing that we're here about. This has always been equalization of income because the joint funds of the parties were not sufficient to meet their respective budgets.
Ms. DeWitt, I just wanted to clarify the J&D provided that it was equitable to calculate a maintenance award by splitting the parties' available income equally. Am I correct?
Yes, you are, Your Honor.
Okay, and so to the extent this judge ordered that same thing, it was consistent with the J&D. Am I correct?
Yes.
So that really isn't an issue, is it? What matters is what amounts can be considered as income or not be considered as income. Am I correct?
Exactly.
And did the judge decide that issue as to what could be decided, could be considered as income by the wife?
He didn't because it wasn't raised prior to or at the original hearing.
So the only thing we have is an affidavit. The only evidence was the affidavit that said these were loans. Am I correct?
That's correct.
And there was no objection or position raised at the time of the hearing as to to whether these were loans or whether the parents were in fact giving regular support to their daughter.
That's exactly correct, John. And so then we have to look at Mr. Gainsley's brief where he relies on the Honke decision to support his argument. So even if the initial court, Referee Fernstahl, should have let this post-hearing evidence in. Remember, it was initially in the form of a letter from counsel. There was no contradicting evidence that was presented, even in Mr. Gainsley's subsequent attempts to try to file things with the court. So he said that his initial letter he sent, the judge didn't respond to. Well, he didn't make a proper motion, and sending a letter to the trier of fact doesn't require the trier of fact to do a response. So what we have here is the husband, or the ex-husband here, trying to bootstrap his argument. It's not simply a mistake. If you go back to the judgment decree, you will see this kind of behavior as inconsistent on the part of husband. And it wasn't a mistake that he didn't file pleadings. And as we can see with the counsel he retained after he didn't like the decision, he has the ability to retain counsel. He just didn't do that. And I'd also point out that from 2017, when he got that substantial reduction in spousal maintenance, until my client saw the LinkedIn notification, he didn't inform my client that his income had gone up substantially. So Mr. Conley has had a huge windfall here. So I'd like to go, though, to the question about numbers that were given to Ms. Devitt. The only issues that were discussed and argued at the hearing were the incomes, earned incomes of the parties. And that's what the court used at the initial trial, earned income of the parties. At the time, Mr. Connolly was successful in his motion to modify earned income of the parties. And here, earned income of the parties. And as the courts can see, maintenance and child support were adjusted slightly upward because the parties' incomes, the current incomes, were slightly higher than they were at the time the judgment and decree was entered. So wife, instead of making $35,000 imputed income, was making actual $41,000. And husband, instead of making $216,000 of income, was actually making $235,000. And so what Referee Bernsfeld did, and what Judge Hatcher adopted, and what Judge Yellowhammer adopted, was the same thing that he did at the trial, which was what husband had asked him to do then, equalize income. So unless the court has any additional questions, and that's the basis of our argument.
Any questions, further questions from the panel? Nope, seeing none. Mr. Gainsley, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. One of the things I think the court must look at when deciding after this morning's hearing is, where did this May 14 order come from? What happened between May 11 and May 14 where the court added the language that they're in the event of trial or evidentiary hearing, only then can cross-examination of Ms. Devitt take place. Only then can either party retain their own financial expert. Why was that language added? It's not in the Rule 706, and the order starts with, consistent with Minnesota Rule Evidence 706, but it's not consistent. It's inconsistent. And we are entitled under the rule to examine or cross-examine, I guess, the neutral. We're entitled to have, and we did retain, our own financial expert to no avail because of this added language that came out of nowhere. Nowhere. Quote, in the event of trial or evidentiary hearing. It just wasn't there on May 11, but popped in on April, excuse me, on May 14. And we know it was prepared by counsel, excuse me, because the register of action shows that counsel submitted it on May 13 and the judge signed it on May 14 with no allowance for us to respond to that, to say to the court, wait a minute, that's not, quote, consistent with Minnesota Rule of Evidence 706. Simply because, and we don't have to rub Mr. Connolly's nose in it. We understand that he erred by not showing. But there's nothing to indicate that he was deficient in discovery. And it's very important for the court to understand that none of this proceeding that we're talking about now, and I'm sorry I didn't raise this in the first instance because I think it's very significant. There's no suggestion that Mr. Connolly was deficient or late in maintenance payments or child support payments, and there's no assertion to the contrary. This goes to whether there should be an increase in maintenance and child support. Not that he's in default. He has been current in child support. He's been current in maintenance. And frankly, he's been current. He was current on discovery. I think it's important for the court to query, if Ms. Connolly was able to get revenue from her family, if Mr. Connolly was current in maintenance and child support, and if she, as she says to Ms. Devitt, has expenses of $15,000 a month, where did she make up the shortfall? Where did the money come from to make up the shortfall that she says she has? We're entitled to know that. That's an important consideration for the court, and one that only discovery can help us ascertain. Finally, I do want to...
Mr. Gainsley, can I ask you this? Are you asserting that Ms. DeVitt in any way miscalculated are used the wrong procedure in doing her work as a financial accountant?
The answer clearly is no.
All right. No. So you're really just contesting the factors she utilized in making her determination. Yes.
It wasn't her fault that she didn't have all the factors before her. She made her assumptions and came to her conclusions based on what she had before her. I'm not blaming her at all. Ms. Devitt is highly competent, and frankly, I've used her many times. She's probably the one I use more than, or her firm more than anyone else. I do want to stand corrected on one thing. One of your honors asked whether the equalization was from the initial decree, and I had forgotten that, yes, the judge said because the parties had lived a standard well beyond their income, the court did adopt the equalization of income. So that has been the rule throughout. Please, Your Honor, take a look at that. What happened between May 11 and May 14. A lot turns on that because they're saying we're not entitled to an evidentiary hearing, and that's begging the question. What they're saying is we're not entitled to an evidentiary hearing because the court has everything it needed. That begs the question.
As I understand it, your assertion is that the evidentiary hearing would be on those factors that were considered by Ms. DeVitt, not her work as a financial accountant and then implementing this.
Nor am I saying it's automatic. Family court, proceeds generally on affidavit. I'm not saying it's automatic that there should be an evidentiary hearing, but based upon the memorandum that would accompany an affidavit showing what the results of discovery, the court could make a decision, no evidentiary hearing is necessary, or I think more likely, the court would say, we have to have an evidentiary hearing. There's too many things that are unknown.
Okay, thank you.
All right, any further questions?
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you to both of you. This case is now submitted. We'll